And today on the podcast, I'm very excited to have Carrie Brownstein of Slater Kinney, the TV show Portlandia, and many, many other things. Slater Kinney has a new album out called Little Rope. Actually comes out this Friday, January 19th, 2024. It is fantastic. Brownstein is one half of Slater Kinney. The other half is Corn Tucker. And I have also interviewed Tucker probably about 10 years ago for when she had her solo project, the Corn Tucker Band. That is not a podcast. It is a transcribed interview. I will link to that in the descriptions. You can read that as well. But if you know music, I don't think you can possibly overstate Slater Kinney's impact on music over the last 30 years. Every superlative applies to them. Iconic, influential, legendary, fantastic, amazing, all of those things. That's not just me. That's musicians. Listen to what they say about the impact Slater Kinney has had. So I am obviously biased because I think they are so good. But, and I am also biased in this sense because I love all the interviews I post. I will start with that. I think there's been only a couple that I have just did not go well, and I never posted for various reasons. You won't know who those people are, but I do. But there are also some interviews I love better than others, and this is one of them because this was clearly a conversation about the writing process. This was not me asking questions and Brownstein just answering. This is a true conversation. The depth of her responses, the introspection, we really get deep into, gosh, I felt like this was, and I don't mean to scare people off, but this was a deep discussion about writing, about the process. And I think that no matter what kind of writer that you are, you'll find this informative. One of the things she starts with is how writing is an act of contemplation. And I love that. And I wish I'd gotten into that with her more in the podcast. But writing is an act of contemplation. And I think that if you only see the writing process as taking place when pen gets put to paper, that can cause a lot of anxiety. But I've always said that the writing process is always taking place, whether you're sleeping, eating, working out, whatever, writing. The writing process is always taking place. And if you see writing as that, the process is that, it can make things less anxious. And I love that idea of writing as an act of contemplation. But that contemplation for Brownstein often takes place, as you will hear, on a cheap couch she found on Craigslist. I actually didn't think people use Craigslist anymore, but apparently they do. And so you'll hear her talk about, and I love this story she tells, about finding this couch on Craigslist in New York. I think it was in New York. And how it's where she loves to write. And there's this kind of almost feeling she has when she's on it that, yeah, you may have all your fancy stuff, your fancy places you like to write, but I've got that cheap used couch I found on Craigslist. That's the part of the ritual that I love. I can listen to stories like that all day. We also talked about people we like to read and all those parts of the process. This is truly one of my favorite interviews I've done, I think, in a long time. So, Carrie, if you're listening to this, thank you very much for a great conversation. Again, Slater Kinney's album is Little Rope. It comes out this Friday. And it's funny because just before recording this, I was watching some old clips of Portlandia, a show I love. And you should also do that as well after you listen to this. I don't post the video for these podcasts, but there are some great facial expressions going on in this interview as well. Enough of that. You want to hear Carrie Brownstein talk. So with that, I should say, here's my interview with Carrie Brownstein of Slater Kinney. So thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I always start by talking about or asking, do you believe me? I find that some songwriters believe that they should be writing in some fashion every day, whether it's, you know, journaling or songwriting, anything. Others say, nope, just when the mood strikes, I don't want to push it. So where do you fall in that spectrum?
Well, somewhere in the middle. I think, as you know, writing is not just the act of writing. It's an act of contemplation. It's an act of being observant and porous and sort of in taking in ideas and feelings. And I think I'm always doing that. I'm always taking notes, writing down ideas, underlining something in a book I'm reading, but I'm not always writing in terms of sitting down with my guitar, trying to come up with a new song. That feels like it happens as we start getting out of, you know, this current album cycle. But I will write intermittently. I do other forms of writing more frequently. And I think songwriting is an extension of that, and that ideas are always percolating.
Are you a journal? Do you like to journal?
I don't have a formal journal process, but I have idea notebooks. And sometimes those contain sort of diaristic, journalistic kind of thoughts, you know, that here's my day. But other times it's just ideas. And yeah, I'm always really envious of people that, you know, they have like a shelf in their room or in their office. It's like, here's all of my journals from the time I was 8 years old. Like, either that's brilliant or just a burden for somebody after you leave, depending on what happens with your life.
It's pretty crazy. So you're no joke. I mean, songwriters who tell me they've kept all those and they go back. But I think songwriters tell me, I think they have three categories: those who journal and love it, those who have no desire to ever start, and then those who don't, but really wish they do. That's probably the biggest number. The people who, every time people talk about this, I really feel like I should be journaling.
I know. It's a guilt is a real motivator there. I think it's because there's something romantic about the idea of self-mythologizing. To me, the act of keeping a diary is kind of an act of self-mythologizing. You know, you're willing yourself into this protagonist role in a way that's a little more heightened than just, you know, sort of the voice in your head. And I love that. I love that as a basis from which to form, you know, song ideas or other ideas, but I just don't have that practice. I do have all of my journals though. And so, yeah. But I already think of them as a burden because I'm like, wow, this is barely legible.
You know, when I look at past things I've written, I wish I could look at those things and say, wow, that's fantastic. It's usually I'm mortified.
You know.
Anything I write, it's always, oh my God, it's never, wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You know what operates as a journal for me and also sort of document of my earlier writing are letters to people, because, you know, before texting and before email, you know, I would have these epistolary relationships, and I wouldn't trust myself to necessarily send the first draft of the letter because I would end up crossing something out or it would be messy. And then I would want to, you know, formalize it and write it out on another sheet of paper. So I have sort of the drafts of these letters that I wrote to people when I was touring. And, you know, that started when I was 19 or 20. And yeah, it's some clumsy writing, but they also do serve kind of as a, you know, a snapshot of that time though.
So do you ever go back to those past writings for song ideas or no?
No,
never.
No, not for current song ideas. Yeah. I sometimes like a journal or like a little notebook from the last couple of years, I'll look through to see if maybe I left an idea on the table that now actually is sort of, you know, lighting my imagination, but often, you know, that's not often the case. And I of course use the ubiquitous, notes app. I have a lot of those.
I ask this question to everyone because I'm fascinated by that. Songwriters typically have, I mean, like what you said, hundreds of voice memos, notes app, but no organization to them whatsoever. So it's frantically going back. And I can tell by the look on your face that you're frantically going back and saying, where are these things? Where is that idea? So no, do you title them? Is there any sense of organization? See, I really wish it were video because that's a great expression.
I just, as you're talking about it again, just the guilt rising up. Yes, I have so many voice memos and they just have a date on them. And then the problem is I'll have voice memos from, you know, say October 10th of 2023 and October 10th of 2022. Like you accumulate these annually and it's often a melody or all a lyric that I'm on a walk and I just need to, you know, dictate a lyric into my phone, or it's me playing guitar. And sometimes I forget about them for a long time because they are not labeled. Yeah. I mean, it's basically just digital garbage. I don't know why I'm thinking of it as any kind of writing tool, but I do trust that the ideas that are good are staying with me, you know, and that I'm not discarding those.
But on the other hand, I feel like if you don't label them, that forces you to go through all of them. Right. And I mean,
it does force you. Yes. There is no shortcut there. You have to reckon with your disorganization. Yep.
But you could find something there that you may have overlooked otherwise. I'm trying to put a spin on this.
I appreciate that positive spin. Yep. I could find something.
Yeah. Because I know I found stuff that I've written again where, you know, deep in the, you know, some hard drive, you know, and it could be something, whatever it is. And it, at the time it was garbage, but after a few years, it's like, actually, I see where this could go now. Maybe that's a bigger question of distance, like how much distance we need from something.
Yeah. I think that's definitely true. I think that sometimes space from an idea, it also isn't trying to be something. There's that kind of like contrivance, I think, that comes from being really high on your own sort of supply and really, really excited about an idea that actually isn't fleshed out or, you know, feels a little partial or inadequate. And then you look at it later and you think, oh, my intention now is not that it is not married to this cleverness. It's now something that has some earnestness to it. You know, it has some thoughtfulness. Whereas when I wrote it down, I was just thinking about how clever it was. And now it's not merely clever. In fact, I don't care if it's clever. It's just, you know, there's something rich here.
Well, Hemingway always said he could never write about Paris when he was in Paris. Like he always needed distance. And I think about that not just as a spatial thing, but also an emotional state as well. Like, is it more effective to write about something when you're in it or with that reflection? And I'm curious with you, what's more effective for you to have that distance is it more effective for you to be right in the moment?
I think both are valid and they have different results. You know, I think with music, there is something about being in the moment. But you're marrying it with something that's timeless. You know, melody sort of is a time traveler. And so it allows the words to, you know, exist and meet people where they're at, but also to meet someone in the future where they're at. And that's something that's something that's magical about all writing. You know, you want that kind of that time traveling characteristic to it. But I do like the feeling of being inspired and writing in the moment. I don't trust that though more than the other thing, but I don't think I disparage either. I think it just depends. You know, sometimes we don't have the luxury of just being able to sit with something. We, you know, not necessarily with music, but I guess a little bit with music, there are deadlines. You know, you have a recording session coming up. Sure, you can cancel it, but you know, just I don't know. Like, you know, we're not trying to put out a record every 10 years, you know, where we were stewing over something and considering it. And, you know, there is also Slater Kinney is a vessel for urgency. You know, it has a quality to it that is restless. And I think restlessness is part of grappling with the moment and feeling out of step with it. So, yeah, I would say with music writing, it's better for me to kind of be living with something and putting it, you know, turning it into music.
So I'm going to read, I've got some quotes over here on my screen from writers that I'd love to read to songwriters and have you react. Okay. So this is from Maya Angelou. She said, there's no greater agony than burying an untold story inside of you. So I'll read that again. There is no greater agony than burying an untold story inside you. I take that to mean, how often do we have the urge to write? Like that primitive urge of saying, I've got to write now. Like there's something, you know, there's something in me. I feel like I have to put this down and write. So I'm curious, how often do you get that urge, or how does that, what does that quote mean to you?
It's interesting. I heard it. I definitely see that perspective. I also thought of it as the very onerous task of writing, which is the idea when it's in your head is fully formed. It's the mansion. It has the roof, it has the windows, it has the furniture, it has the yard. It's so much detail. And then you go to write it and you realize, oh my goodness, I have to create that on the paper. Like this is a shack. This is not a mansion. And so when I heard that quote, I actually thought, oh, yes, it is a beast to have this idea inside you, because the idea now is going to take all of this labor in order to, you know, be able to explain, to tell the story as richly as it exists in one's mind. But to your point, when do I have the urge to write? A lot of the time. But again, you know, you write down the idea, but that's just the idea. You know, oh, this would, and sometimes I think it takes the discipline is to then not just be a generator of ideas, but a generator of stories, to finish something, to have the patience and the diligence, you know, to do the work. And whether that's with songwriting or essays or other things that I write, you know, that often, that initial excitement, which I hear in that quote, that initial sort of drive and compulsion, then sort of butts up against the reality of, oh, this is going to take hours. I thought this idea seemed so formed in my head. Why am I still tinkering over a line hours later? I thought it was there. And that's what you start to realize, you know, the kind of chasm between, you know, idea and actual results.
Well, I know exactly what you mean. I have what I think sometimes are great ideas in my head, but as they travel down my arms and leave my fingertips, they don't look anything like they did up here.
That's our only task. We're supposed to be able to convey what that is.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because when you say that, I see that as when I start to write, and I'm a prose writer, not a songwriter, so it's different. But I don't think I've any right knowing what it's supposed to look like when I start. To me, the biggest impediment is I've got that idea down there and I'm going to get there. Now that's just me, but I feel like when I write, I have no idea where I'm going to go end up. And I like being able to kind of take those avenues, you know, go around that corner that maybe I didn't know was there. So for me, at least the hardest thing for me is to think I know how it's supposed to look when I'm finished.
Yeah. I think ideally you don't know, right? I mean, I'm not a news reporter, you know, you don't know. And I think that's what, especially with music, that's what really excites me, is that I don't want to be able to predict, you know, the songs feel very alive to me. You know, they have this animistic quality, and they, until we record them, they still feel mutable and malleable. And then what's beautiful about music is then you play them live, and then it's like sort of you're reanimating them every night, and you still don't know exactly how they're going to sound or end. You know, I mean, you have a rough idea. Ideally you are ending on the right note along with the rest of the band, but in terms of the feeling, the journey of it, you don't quite know. And that, I think, is what makes music writing really special, is because there's so much repetition involved. If you're lucky, you're out there playing these songs, and they can mean something different every time.
Now, when it comes to those lyrics, are you a pen and paper person or a computer person?
Pen and paper, for sure.
Yeah.
I eventually, I end up documenting them, writing them into a, you know, some kind of software where I can print it out and put it on a music stand and sing into the mic. But process is always pen and paper for me. Even if I have an idea in a notes app, because I've been out walking and come up with an idea, I will end up transferring that into a notebook.
Oh, really?
So I can cross out. I like that process. It sometimes works concomitant to the notes app. Well, we'll have something in there that's kind of percolating, and then I'll sort of transfer that over to something else. And I think it's just because I process information a little differently in those mediums. And one is slightly more emotional. That's just for lyric writing, though. Like, yeah. If I'm doing other kinds of writing, it's all on my computer. I'm not someone that's overly romanticizing of the, you know, paper, or, you know, writing is writing. Yeah.
But I do find that songwriters are very loyal to color of ink, even type of pen. We don't have to mention brand names, or even type of paper, you know, because it gives them a sense of comfort. So Do those things matter to you at all?
Yeah. I like having a certain kind of pen, certain kind of ink.
What color ink?
Black. I don't really like here, I have this nice pen right here. What is this one? UniPen, fine line, water and fade proof. I like this one.
Yeah.
And I like a little notebook. I'm less particular about the notebooks. I think I just like a new notebook. I like the feeling of having something that is like the container for my ideas for a while. I'm not like a Moleskine person where they all have to be of this certain, you know, size or, shape or feel. As long as there's a notebook there that's kind of holding everything together for a while.
I'm fascinated by the ritual of the process, right? I mean, whether it's superstition. I mean, I interviewed Jerry Harrison from the Talking Heads a couple of months ago. He said it has to be a felt tip pen because he loves the scratching feeling of the felt tip on the on the paper. You know, and again, who knows if it works, but I think, you know, for me, you know, like I write in this chair, but I revise in the chair behind me. And I find that I need, when I revise, I need distance. Like I cannot write and revise in the same place. For me, at least, and that process needs to be different. But is the ritual important? Some people say it's not, like it doesn't matter. But I love reading those Paris Review interviews with writers, and they all talk about, you know, they have a specific ritual they have for the most part. So is that idea of a ritual, you know, with a capital R, important to you?
I think it's become more important to me in terms of, I went through, the last couple of years have been difficult. I lost my mother, and I have found that ritual is a way of, I guess, giving shape to my days. And also it's almost like prayer meditation, where it's just returning to the practice. It's tending to, and it's caretaking. It's all of these acts of love, essentially. And I appreciate how writing, whether it's guitar or lyrics, is ritualized. That, because what ritual to me also means is that it's a choreography that I know. So I'm enacting something that is familiar, but that has the possibility of being met with, you know, something unfamiliar, something strange, but the vessel for it is the same, right? The routine is the same, there might be a new step in there. But I think that practice of doing something over and over and over again, is really important. And it's kind of a beautiful part of life. I mean, yes, like having novelty is great, and, you know, like being open to new experiences. But I think ultimately, like, giving meaning to our days is something that ritual does. And I feel grateful for it. And I feel like as a writer, I utilize it more and realize that if I'm in the same routine, like if I wake up and have coffee and then walk my dog, I need that ambulatory moment in the morning. I need to be outside. I need to have fresh air. I need to just sort of observe and listen and kind of let ideas sort of swirl around in the ether. And I'll just kind of think about something for a while. If it's a song, I might just sing it and see how the words feel in my mouth, see what is off, see what is like sort of conspicuously, I don't know, just out of place, I guess, or clumsy. And then I'll come home and the dog is tired and I'll eat some food and sit down and write. And I like that. I'm a morning person. I will edit later. But in terms of the actual like creativity, new ideas, that has to come pretty early for me. I like the quiet of the morning. I like how it feels like a city is still waking up and I'm early to do that instead of sort of joining the bustle of the day. But once I'm editing, once something's down on the page, I can do that. You know, I can sit in a comfortable chair on a couch and put my computer on my lap. If I'm, you know, sort of, if I'm in that mode, then I can do that. But everything else has to be a little more constructed.
Do you have I have a favorite chair. Do you have a favorite chair that you like to write in?
Well, I will sit in this office chair, but I really like, I have a couch that I found on Craigslist. I'm a real Craigslist person and people hate Craigslist. People are shocked that I use it. They're like, isn't that just scams and like people out to just like either have sex with you or steal your money or never show up
or both
or all of those things. And I'm like, listen, the great thing about Craigslist, if I can plug Craigslist, although caveat emptor, of course, but is that people don't use it as much. So you occasionally find a great deal because it's someone that isn't using Facebook Marketplace or Nextdoor or some other, you know, newfangled way of selling merchandise to their neighbor. And so you get a great deal. I've found cars on there. I've found music equipment and I've found sofas. I mean, a perfectly sofa. This couple moved from New York. And they had this giant sofa. They had moved into a smaller apartment and they had this beautiful, what I knew would be an expensive couch, just sitting in a temperature controlled storage space. Anyway, love writing on that couch. And I think there's also something that I feel like a little sense of like smugness about it. I'm like, look at this great, comfortable, expensive sofa that I got a great deal on. And now I'm going to write on the sofa. Like I like a sort of storied sort of piece of furniture that nothing that is, you know, too austere or generic, I guess.
I mean, I think knowing, being aware of those things, I mean, I do some of my writing here, but I have a place I go where if I'm not feeling it here, mm-hmm. there's another place I go. I don't go anywhere in the house. There's a certain room I go to. And again, I think that's comforting, but that I love that idea of the ritual, whether it works or not, but that comfort of knowing, okay, it's worked here before, it should be able to work here again.
Yeah. And occasionally I'm also a big believer if you can, it's not possible for everyone. I take myself on little writer's retreats. I find a little motel or Airbnb and the woods or near the beach. And sometimes if I'm trying to jumpstart a project or just have kind of a intensive writing session, I need to actually take myself out of that ritual and routine and sort of impose a new structure, you know, new, I guess sort of parameters on the writing. And that forces an intense focus that I like. It doesn't always work. Sometimes I get out there and I'm like, oh, this is, now I'm just on vacation and it feels like a total waste. But I would say 90% of the time it does work. And it just really, it gives me almost license to just work on something all day, you know, and not feel like I'm going to suddenly default to some task, you know, some sort of like household, you know, ordinary task that can become then a distraction or a means of procrastination. Like it just removes all of those sort of comforts and familiarities.
I want to ask you about the one more thing about the notebook, and that is, do you find that writing in a notebook allows you to make the songwriting process less linear, where you can kind of write things? Are your notebooks in orderly fashion? I mean, you're nodding no. So, but I think the freedom of that, it lets you just kind of put stuff everywhere, and I think that's the advantage, right?
Yes, it's very collage oriented and very sort of blue sky, which is a term that we used in writers' rooms on TV shows. Blue sky is sort of, you know, it's the early days of brainstorming. But notebooks to me feel like they're always kind of in that blue sky, you know, brainstorm collage period. And that does kind of deny or sort of hold off a linear mode of approaching things and lets, I think, ideas be a little ambient, and for you to have to draw connections between, you know, sometimes disparate things. And I do like that with lyrics, or if I start to realize I'm like circling around a motif and that, you know, one sort of version of it, one, you know, analogy or metaphor, or one particular mode of, well, like one narrator might be the stronger sort of driver for that story, then I'll realize like, oh, this is a variation on a theme here, but this is the strongest version of that. And I'll notice that if I'm sort of leafing through a notebook. And I have noticed that too, as I'm going through old notebooks, like, oh, I was really circling around this idea for a while, and then I landed on it here.
So when you revise, I'll tell you, I've learned this about myself. When I revise, I find that if I finish something in the morning and I look at it later that same day, it's still too close to me. I'm still too protective of it. It's like, well, hell, I wrote that. Damn, I'm not getting rid of it, of anything here. But if I finish something at night, sleep on it, wake up the next day, it's unbelievable how aggressive I can be with my concision, with my cuts. I don't know if it's a sleep thing, if it's a distance thing. That's my trick. Like, I know that if I can't get rid of anything, one night's sleep always solves it. So I'm curious, do you have any, you know, revision? What are your effective revision techniques? I guess in any type of writing that you're doing.
I agree. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be sleep, but it has to be time. You know, just putting distance between, you know, the whatever the last thing I did, whatever paragraph or line I ended on, and then when I come back and revisit it, usually I'm much less, you know, precious about it. Give yourself more time, and you're even, you know, more lacerating. You're more critical. But I think with a little time, you can, you know, distill what's good or worth keeping, or have perspective on potentially that none of it is, you know, but in the moment it all feels so well earned and so hard fought for that you want to keep all of it. But I definitely, sometimes it's a night's sleep, and other times it's a few days and then revisiting. Obviously, if I'm working on something that has a little more of a deadline to it, like if we're in the middle of recording and, you know, I see that, okay, tomorrow I'm going to sing the song, I'll pull up the lyrics and realize, oh, there's still some lines that need tweaking. Then I sort of have a deadline. I will do exactly what you're saying, which is finish at night and then in the morning revisit. I think that's a useful method.
You mentioned earlier, and I've got one of my other quotes, is that Agatha Christie said, the best time to write a book is when you're doing the dishes. So I take that to mean that. And a lot of songwriters tell me this, that they get great ideas, melodies, lyrics, when they're participating in mundane activities, vacuuming, gardening. There was an article in the Washington Post about 6 months ago, why we get our best ideas in the shower. Mm-hmm. Something about the mundane activity allows the subconscious to bubble. And I firmly believe that. So I'm curious if that happens to you a lot, where you're getting those ideas when you're doing things that require no thought whatsoever.
Absolutely. And I walk as you know, that activity, which, you know, putting one foot in front of the other is something I've been doing for a long time. Doesn't take much thought. I usually have my dog with me. So sometimes if he's distracted, then I'm distracted for a moment too. But for the most part, I try to not listen to podcasts or music or audiobooks. I try to just leave myself open to being receptive to ideas. I'll, you know, toy with a melody or a lyric. And the shower is good because for singing, and it's cliche, but you have great reverb in there. So I'll often try out melodies in there. Like Modern Girl, which is a Slater Kinney song I wrote a long time ago. It's on the woods. I came up with in the shower, the melody for it. And yeah, I mean, it's just, it's a great place for some natural reverb. But I agree that there's something about a mundane task, I think. And that's what's important. That's what's so interesting to me about people who start to excise, you know, as people, sorry, bumped my mic, as people get more successful, you start excising those activities from your life and you get scheduled out. It's not even success. It's busyness. It's life. You know, you can start to think that, oh, well, now I can afford to have somebody else do that. Or now I don't have time to do that. So I'm no longer, you know, sort of like participating in like the daily activities, like the, you know, the sort of tasks, the sort of ordinary quotidian tasks. But those, I think, as creative people, are often not only where the ideas come from, but what gives me the drive to actually do something creative. Like if I am just entrenched in the mundane for a while, or like entrenched in sort of some annoying task that's taking a while, I'm suddenly hungry to write. I need it. I need that desire. I need to sort of have something impeding my progress. And every once in a while, walks don't do that necessarily, but sometimes other ordinary tasks, I get a little kind of restlessness at the end of it. And I'm like, well, now I want to write because I haven't been able to. And yeah. I think you can kind of trick your brain into doing that, right? You just give yourself like, oh, I have to go and work in the garden, or I have to run these errands. And all of a sudden I'm like, I want to get home.
That's so interesting. I've never gotten that response before. Typically it's, you know, folding clothes, doing laundry, gardening, vacuuming, that act in itself. But I like what you're saying, that that just drives you crazy after a while. And you've got to create because your mind has just been doing nothing, right?
Yeah. I like to miss something, you know, I want to sort of like dive back into it with some energy and, you know, voraciousness.
Yeah. All right. Another quote. This is from H.L. Mencken. The value of writing seems to be in inverse proportion to the ease of writing. Whatever flows freely and bubblingly turns out to be sorry stuff a week later. So I relate that again. Some songwriters tell me they don't trust the stuff that comes quickly. Others say that's the best stuff.
Well, Slater Kinney has now been around for a while. And I will say early on, you know, when we were 19, 20, you know, probably up to 25, those first couple albums, first idea, best idea. I mean, that is the essence of punk or rock or so much music, you know, doesn't matter the genre, just, you know, what you're essentially doing is bringing ideas you've had since you were like a teenager, adolescent, and everything has sort of been percolating for a long time. And then you're finally given this showcase, you know, this means of, you know, telling your story. So I often think, you know, that's the first novel. That's the first movie. That's the first album. You know, it's like, oh, this is my big idea and here it is. But later on, I think the longer I've been doing something, I agree mostly with Mencken in that I am skeptical of things that come easy. That doesn't mean I dismiss them, but I have to at least assess them and make sure that it feels different enough, sounds different enough, is moving the narrative, meaning like the broader narrative of this band, forward enough that I'm not just repeating something, or, you know, just kind of doing what I know and assuming that that's good enough because I've practiced it many times or it's been successful in the past. Like, so I think there's just a kind of a healthy skepticism that starts to creep in about that which comes easy. But I think it's dangerous to outright dismiss it because ideally there's sort of a balance. And, you know, some things are more laborious and take more time and you wrestle and tinker with forever. And it turns out great, but it could be not as great as the thing that you wrote in a day. So I think you have to be open to it and either have collaborators or your own enough self-awareness to determine the quality of something without that being the only litmus test.
Right. All right, last question. So I read every day. I think it's important, obviously. I get very anxious when I don't. That's the one thing that actually physically makes me feel like I need to be reading. More so than writing, I feel like I have to be reading. When I don't, it really bothers me. But I'm not an author person. So what I mean is when I finish a book, my first reaction isn't, oh, let me read everything by that person. It's let me get other voices in my head.
Okay.
And that's just me where I'm never like, I don't have a favorite author because I just will go on to something else immediately. Like right now I'm reading the Best American Short Stories, the anthology. And I love it because it's something different every time.
The grand one, like the of all time, because don't they do? They do a yearly one, don't they?
No, it's the yearly one. It's okay, the one okay. That was edited by. It's 22, 23 just came out. 2022 one was edited by Greer, the guy that wrote Less. I forgot his first name, but anyway, let's talk reading habits. So, are you a genre person, an author person, literary influences? Let's have at it.
Sure. I have a dear friend who is a creative writing professor, and what she has helped me curate and sift through is contemporary fiction because, you know, it's daunting. We are, you know, the canon is massive and it keeps growing, thankfully, and including more people, but there's a lot of writing from, you know, hundreds of years ago to more recently that we have missed. And so for a while, I just felt kind of cowed by that. And I would be kind of a completist about things like, okay, you know, now I'm reading everything by Jane Austen. Now I'm reading everything by Somerset Maugham, everything by Philip Roth, you know, like all this, everything by James Baldwin. It was a lot. It can get exhausting and overwhelming. And it's the fun sort of, you know, just the joy of it starts to kind of drain. But I definitely did that in my 20s after I think feeling guilty for not, even though I was a good student and good in English, I would sort of just skim those books. And then I was like, oh my God, now I need to actually read Tolstoy. You know, I was remiss during high school. Anyway, so I did a lot of catching up. And now I just dig into contemporary fiction. So, you know, I just finished Northwoods by Daniel Mason. I thought it was beautiful. I like Rachel Cusk. I liked the latest Deborah Levy book. I like James McBride. I like Zadie Smith, I like Anna Napolitano. Like there's just, to me, there's so many great contemporary fiction writers. I either have a friend give me recommendations or I go to a local bookstore and I'm lucky to live in Portland where there are a ton of independent bookstores. And I go in and I just look at their staff picks or talk to someone there and they'll point me in the right direction. So I'm a real fiction reader right now. I think that we're living in such a hellacious, like, era of nonfiction in terms of like what's happening in the world. That I used to enjoy, I think, you know, history books and like biographies and stuff like that. But now I dive into fiction and I kind of just use that as escape, to be honest. Like, you know, the same way I might watch a film or TV show, but I feel more edified ultimately by a great book. I like getting hooked. I still like that feeling of getting hooked where you sort of pass a certain page count and then just are obsessed. Like that to me is still a gratifying feeling that I don't necessarily, I binge watch TV like everyone, but it's a different auto response, visceral response to getting hooked on a book and just returning to that sort of insular private world, private relationship that you have with the book in your hand and the pages. I'm not a digital reader. I still buy the actual like hard or paperback book. And I sometimes do listen to audiobooks. So I'm usually reading a book and then listening to an audiobook. I'm a total genre fan in audiobooks. They have to be a mystery. I go for the thriller. It's stuff I wouldn't normally pick up and read, but I love if I'm going to walk and listen to something or drive and listen to something, it has to be just a real page turner.
So can you read more than one book at a time? I usually read two, but they have to be different types of books. So I'm reading a short story anthology, and then I'm reading An Immense World by Ed Young. It won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction last year, I think. And it's all, he's a writer for The New Yorker, and it's all about animal senses and about how we're basically, it's fascinating about how we tend to project our senses. You know, we see an animal outside and it's cold and we think, oh, the animal's got to be cold. And really animals, like they're seeing things, hearing things that we can't even comprehend.
Wait, I'm going to write that down. Ed Young.
Immense World by Ed Young, Y-O-N-G.
Okay. Yeah. I want to check that out.
Yeah.
That kind of projection and
fascinating
anthropomorphizing that we do with animals. It's not even really good for our pets, like especially dogs. There's all this literature about how we've just ruined dogs, given them so much anxiety by just requiring them to basically be like our children or our best friends. And they used to have all these jobs that they did, you know, dogs used to work, and now their job is to just like hang out on your couch and like give you like emotional comfort. And they're like, I'm sad and anxious. No wonder. Yeah. So anyway, I will check that out.
And I just like that because I don't think I could read two nonfiction books at a time because I feel like I believe that as I'm reading the short stories, the nonfiction book is somewhere in my head. I don't know what's happening, but it's doing something back there and I'm coming to grips with it. So, and I find that just reading two different books at this, I've talked to some songwriters who read five books at a time. I don't know how they do that.
Are they really reading? I mean, I'm not doubting anyone. I do think that, yes, if you differentiate by genre or if you're going fiction, nonfiction, I definitely think you can, or something that's a compendium, you know, you're just now, you know, I'm reading an essay. I can definitely be deep into a New Yorker and reading a book, but I tend to have to kind of do some switching, but I can do fiction and fiction if one's audio and one's just actually reading a book. But again, that audio book is, you know, I don't want to disparage genre because I'm a big fan of it, but it's a different beast. It's a different beast.
Yeah, I think audiobooks are great, I think, for the certain types of literature, right? I'm not sure that I could listen to an audiobook of someone who's known for the beauty of the language. That's just me. You know, I think I may need to see those words on the page to appreciate it more.
Yeah, well, plus the interpreter, aka the narrator, the performer, you know, what I love about reading is you get the character's voice in your head or the writer's voice in your head. And, you know, that is very personal. And so you have to really trust, you don't want to ruin a book by having some narrator impose this voice in your head. So it's delicate. And there's some great, great, you know, audiobook voice actors, of course, but I think it's very particular. And I think the genre is, again, like mystery thriller, very well suited for the audiobook because it's just like listening to someone tell you like a ghost story, you know, and that's more in the oral tradition. I think I will listen to someone tell me this, you know, dire, fraught, you know, horror story. That's fun to listen to.